Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Now we're in depth on a cautionary future not so far, far away. Yang is the big brother robot Kira and her husband have added to their family. He speaks Chinese, he's nice to the little girl, and he's not much trouble until his electronics short out and can't be repaired. How will they tell their daughter that her brother is dead? That's the scenario in Alexander Weinstein's first story in his new collection, and an indication of how he's contemplating the space that technology is usurping in our lives. Mr. Weinstein told Rolling Stone that technology and virtual reality are infantilizing our culture. I wonder if you agree. Are the techno games that we play and the virtual worlds that we escape into, are they childish? What kind of purpose do they serve in your life? And here's another question for you. I'm going to be reading in the next couple of months a science fiction classic, one that's been influential to contemporary science fiction writers. What should I read? So talk about and think about the games, the virtual worlds we go into, whether that's kind of in a childish escape. And then I'd love it if you'd add a recommendation of the sci-fi classic I should read in the next couple months, one that's been influential to contemporary science fiction today. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can talk to me about all of that on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. Alexander Weinstein is director of the Martha's Vineyard Institute of Creative Writing. His new collection is called Children of the New World. And he joins us today from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Alexander, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Great to be here. Thanks so much.
Further infantilization is how you put it in that interview that you did with Rolling Stone. And you mentioned Pokemon Go. Tell me what you were thinking about as you considered that.
Well, you know, you look at what we're doing with our phones, right? Go to the bus stop and look around, and people are launching birds, crushing candy. you look in the streets, and there are people staring down at their phones trying to capture these monsters all around, right?
I saw that yesterday, by the way. I could not figure out what the guy was doing until I realized it's Pokemon Go. That's what's going on.
Completely. It's totally bizarre, right? And then we have even more bizarreness, where there are people falling off cliffs, like grown men are falling off cliffs looking for Pokemon Go and needing help, right? So when I say infantilization, it's sort of that childishness, which has a good side for sure, but also I think a less critical side that we're being invited into because of technology.
What's the good side first, and then we'll get to the less critical side?
Well, I think there's a playfulness that we've longed for as certainly as humans and as adults. You see this in some ways with these adult coloring books that are coming out now, right? There's this sort of return to less seriousness. I know, right?
No, Alexander, I'm going to get in so much trouble here because I wrote about the adult coloring books in a, let's just say, critical way. I was inundated with angry tweets and emails. Oh my gosh, people were so mad for so long.
Right. Well, that's because, I mean, I think that there is this urge to get out of the seriousness of our culture right now, right? And there's a lot of reasons for that wish for escape. I mean, Donald Trump is running for president. That's dystopian and horrible enough to make anyone want to just color in a coloring book, right? But there's a lot of reasons to want that play again and to return. So in some ways, if I'm to be optimistic about these little games we play, it is that sweet side of ourselves, right? That childish side that wants to return to a kind of playfulness. But at the same time, I see us really getting lost in our devices and pretty much addicted to them, right? If you stop at a red light, you look over, you see people trying to send off one last email, one last text message before the light turns green. Go ahead.
But let me ask you, getting lost in a way that says, look, I can multitask and I feel pressured to do that, or getting lost in a way that we're ignoring the kind of human interaction that's really essential for an enriched life?
Yeah, both. I'd say both, because we are multitasking, all right? And in many ways, technology has given us less time so that many people text rather than call their friends at this point, adults and millennials alike. And there's this sort of shortening of, essentially time management when it comes to our own interpersonal relationships. And so the multitasking, I think, we're all feeling, right? You need to update your Twitter account, put on a new post, put filters on a Facebook post you're about to do, like things, update your Netflix queue, whatever it is. We're spending so much time multitasking. And then simultaneously, we're missing these human interactions, right? It's not uncommon to go to the restaurant and see a whole family sitting around the table, everyone texting and playing with their phones.
Okay, so is this really about how it's crept into places in our lives where games and technology didn't used to be? Because, you know, my mother loves nothing more than gathering a group of friends together and playing Canasta. That's a game.
Mm-hmm.
She gets a lot of fulfillment. I know how to play it, love to play it. She gets a lot of fulfillment out of that. What's the difference between the kind of enjoyment we've always taken in games and what we're doing with technological games?
I think it's the human aspect of actual humans in a room together.
Okay.
Right? This kind of community where getting together with a group of folks and playing Canasta or Scrabble. You could compare Scrabble, let's say, to Words with Friends, where people are then communicating that way, texting one another, sending messages. And there is a definite community built in that way, or a friendship built in that way. Of course, at the same time, we're all sitting alone in our houses playing these games with virtual friends, so to speak, right, or virtually playing these games. And I think that there's loss of maybe downtime there where in between the game, would you like a cup of tea? Can I get you something? How are things going? Just a disconnectedness from the screens. Look outside. Isn't it beautiful? Maybe we should go for a walk today. That might happen, right?
Yeah, we can play Candy Crush, and that'd be a lot more fun.
That's right. Or, let's go search for Pokemon in the woods. At least that's, I guess, a positive, right?
Right. Here's a call from Maria in Fargo. Hi, Maria. How are you thinking about what Alexander's saying here?
Well, I totally agree with him. Like I was telling the producer, I'm 30 and I'm not a huge fan of social media. The only reason I just opened a Twitter account is because I recently started my own business. But I think that as a culture, America has always been kind of more of a solo. You go to Europe, there's people sitting outside in the cafes chatting with complete strangers.
Mm-hmm.
And the prevalence of games is a lot more popular here just because traditionally we've always been an on-your-own type of culture. And my husband's a huge fan of Facebook games, and it causes a lot of fights in our household just because I do say, quit acting like a kid, just get yours. And some of it is a good thing, but most of it is just a waste of time, and we could all just do well with a little bit more social interaction.
Boy, I think there's something to what she's saying, Alexander. What do you think?
Oh, completely, right? Both with the European comment,
right?
Which is interesting, too, because I've been looking at the selfie stick as the flag of surrender that we're all holding up to technology.
Yeah.
Right? And you go to Europe now and you'll see all these different people where once upon a time around a fountain, people might be talking to one another. Now everybody's holding out these selfie sticks and having these kind of solo pictures, right? And nobody's asking each other, would you mind taking a picture of me and my, husband or me and my wife? And so there's that. And then there is also this disappearing, right? The World of Warcraft is a little dated, but you have these World of Warcraft marriages where people disappeared into their video games. Or
so
Second
weird.
Life, where people are getting married on Second Life they're already married in the real world.
Right.
But then they have online wives and husbands, right? So I think that, the video game culture in many ways is this hope for escape again, just to wind down.
Right. Right?
And in many ways, this is what's so weird about technology is that we wind down from technology with technology, Right. So we've had a long day of emailing. And so let me just rest before bed. I'll scroll through Facebook for the next hour just to wind down, right?
Yeah. Hey, I'm really glad you're with me today because you heard me say in the introduction that I'm closing in on choosing a science fiction classic. Here's the deal. It was one of my bookish resolutions at the beginning of the year to read more science fiction. Mm. I've failed so far, Alexander. So you are helping me fulfill my resolution. And as part of trying to do this by the end of the year, I want to read a classic that has influenced contemporary science fiction. So I'll ask you about that later. But I'm also going to take some calls, if you're okay with that, on some recommendations.
Sounds great.
Good. And then maybe you can weigh in on what you think of some of these suggestions. 651-227-6000 to talk to me about a science fiction classic that's influential in contemporary literature and some of the ideas that Alexander and I are talking about this morning, the infantilization that we're experiencing through technology. 800-242-2828. Lots of good suggestions coming in on Twitter. It's at Carrie NPR. To Liz in Woodbury. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Carrie. Hey. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a book recommendation.
Okay.
And I'm just like you. I'm not super into science fiction, but I actually really enjoyed the book by Ray Bradbury, The Martian Chronicles. It's a bunch of short stories that take place on Mars or have to do with Mars.
What? So tell me what resonated with you about The Martian Chronicles that doesn't usually get to you through science fiction.
I think even though it has a lot of aspects of science fiction, it's just the way that he writes. And I'm an English major from the University of Minnesota, and so I really like reading well-written books or well-written stories.
And who doesn't?
And I think the fact that the stories are really well-written is what resonates with me.
Liz,
and I think, like, if you're reading a good book, then, yeah.
Right. Let me recommend Children of the New World. May I do that? That's the book we're talking about today. So, Alexander, Ray Bradbury and The Martian Chronicles. Tell me how you think about that.
Well, so I should right off the bat say that I'm not hugely read in science fiction, which may be surprising since—
It is surprising.
Right? My work is speculative fiction in many ways. But I have read Bradbury. I haven't read The Martian Chronicles. He's a fantastic writer and love his work. I think about—he has a short story, All Summer in a Day, I believe it's called, where the sun comes out once a year, or maybe it's even further than that. Maybe it takes— you know, many years, and one child is locked into the closet, the schoolroom closet, and misses this great opportunity. And I think now that I'm thinking about my own collection, there's the story Rocket Knight, right, where the horrible school board sends the least like child into space in a rocket ship, never to return. And there's a way that Bradbury, that story, that sort of evilness in his story there, helped inspire that.
Wait a minute. That description of that story that you just gave doesn't sound all that different from, I'm trying to think of it, it's not The Cartographers. What's the story in your collection?
Yeah, the story Rocket
Child. Oh, yeah. That's what you were describing. Got it.
Right, exactly. Yeah, where they send that kid off. And
right.
it's a kind of evil by the school board and parents. Yeah, it is. That connection, I realized, I didn't even realize Bradbury was in my subconscious there, but he sure was.
Exactly. So I noticed that you made the distinction, as Margaret Atwood does, between science fiction and speculative fiction, and you called your writing speculative fiction. What's the difference?
I think in a real formal way, science fiction, at least hard science fiction, requires that there be scientific backing to whatever fantasies you come up with. They should be justifiable by science, and often they utilize that to establish the world. Whereas speculative fiction has a looser connection to science in that way. Much of the technology in my stories, I don't explain how it is logically possible. Mm. I just take it as the premise that this is how things work. And so speculative fiction can dip into a lot of different genres, right? There's ability to borrow from magical realism, borrow from fantasy, borrow from sci-fi, and then also have its foot firmly planted in literary fiction.
Call here from Shay in Plymouth. Hi, Shay.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing good. Glad you called. What are you thinking about?
Thank you. Well, I just wanted to, I think this is a very interesting conversation, and I think it's needed. I wanted to say that I really agree with everybody, the previous caller, talking about, you know, her husband and how it causes, you know, conflict in their home sometimes. But I also wanted to point out that things like coloring and coloring books, things like that, things like playing these games, they bring the heart rate down. They allow us as adults to, take care of our inner child. And sometimes our inner child takes care of us as adults. And I think it's very important, especially in this society, America. You know, we're always telling kids, you know, be a man, you're a boy, you have to be a man, or put on your big girl panties, or whatever. And those things, I think, defeat and take chips at our soul. And so the other thing I'd like to say is that even though, you know, coloring in it's about balance in all things. You know, we have to take care of our inner child because our inner child takes care of us, but we do have to balance that with human interaction, with social interaction, with actual people, put the technology down at times.
Shay, this is really well said. I mean, I heard from a lot when I was writing about and talking about how I did not understand the appeal of adult coloring books. I was hearing from people who were saying, hey, it's nothing more complicated than self-care. I know, you know, this is not what I'm going to be doing all day, but it's something that is kind of important to taking a break. And Alexander, you probably wouldn't disagree with that.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of inviting play, especially when I teach creative writing. There's a great deal of play that I think is necessary to write well, to take chances in your writing, to rediscover that place that for many of my students was pushed down somehow throughout their education, right? I have a lot of students who have always wanted to write, and they were told by parents, by the community, that's crazy, stop doing writing, find something meaningful to do with your life, right? And inviting those students to actually play on the page and have some time to explore their imagination is hugely freeing for them. And in many of my classes, I bring in other exercises where for half an hour, especially here during the fall, I take the students outside and we play a game where you try to catch the leaves that are falling from the trees, which seems, you know, completely random to do in university. But the students return to this playfulness where they previously were deeply enmeshed in their personalities, right? They're the sports guy, they're, you know, the cheerleader, they're science major, and now they're running around comparing who got them and was somebody cheating. And you see this joy coming out with the students that then leads to greater creativity.
I was just reading something by a researcher who heads up an institute of, I think it's adult play. And
yeah,
he makes the argument that we've lost a lot of the sense of play that binds us as a community, that is really essential. That sense of the interacting with a sense of play to feeling connected to people in our community. It was a pretty persuasive argument.
Oh, yeah, completely. I think we need it. And in many ways, some of the stuff that I critique in this case, I'm thinking of emoticons now, right? And how emoticons are slipping into our text messages. We're moving into a kind of cartoonish hieroglyphics.
That's true.
That may be, again, this wish for playfulness or this wish for a childhood that has been too quickly pushed out of us because of ultimately probably the demands of capitalism and the way schooling systems are set up to become very product-oriented at the end and very production-oriented.
Erin has a recommendation for me. She says, I vote for the parable of the sewer and the parable of the talents, both by Octavia Butler. So reflective of our current world. I can see, Alexander, I'm going to need to read more than one classic here because we're getting so many. Here's Eric who says, The Diamond Age, Cryptonomicon or Anthem by Neal Stephenson. And to the phones, to Teresa in St. Paul. Hi, Teresa. What's
Hi,
your
Carrie.
Recommendation for me? Hi.
I just recently read on Audible A Childhood's End by Arthur C. Clarke.
Okay.
And there's so many things to say about it, but the one thing that really struck me was there was a lot in there about machines and robotics and how they're going to take over normal work,
mm-hmm.
and people will enter an age of prosperity, but that creates its own problems. So I think people think of Arthur C. Clarke as a rather, common, of course, Arthur C. Clarke equals science fiction, but there was a tremendous amount of philosophy and thinking about people and their place in the world that was just surprising to me.
Your comment here, your suggestion, Therese, is really well timed, because I wanted to talk to Alexander here about the first story in the collection, and it's about this family that brings a robot in as a brother into the family. Arthur C. Clarke, I mean, this is something that I think Arthur C. would have really resonated with Arthur C. Clarke, which you're writing about that, Alexander.
Yeah, Sweet Yang, right? The Chinese, big quotes around Chinese robot, that poor kid, right?
Yeah. Let's tell a little bit about the scenario that you've set out. This is a family that adopts for their daughter. You know, they struck me as parents who want what all parents want, the best thing for their child. But they bring a robot into the family, and they kind of ignore what are going to be what I think of as the obvious problems with this.
Yeah, and so they adopted a Chinese girl who had suffered. There was an earthquake, right, in China, and so they adopt this Chinese girl. And they decide to get robots because there's another subplot where a lot of people are cloning in the society,
mm-hmm.
and they don't want to be cloners, right? There's this idea that cloners just want perfect kids that look just like them, and this family wants a little more of a normal upbringing for their daughter. And of course, then they get a robot, which is the other way of functioning in this society, which is equally absurd. But they don't think so, right? They think this is a way of kind of keeping a little more organic or with the earth by getting a robot.
And tell us a little more about how he fits in. I loved your descriptions about whether, you know, Yang will interact, but he's always got kind of this machine-like reaction that the humans just can't quite ignore.
Yeah, he's pretty much an early model. I think probably the problems this family encounters will be avoided 5 years in the future from the story. You know, they probably will fix the model, I imagine, but in this case, yeah, he has a robotic voice that they're a little worried about their daughter picking up his speech patterns. He's very awkward. He sort of just does what he needs to, and yet he has this secret life that they find out about later, where he's creating little art projects in secret, or he buys a baseball glove, doesn't explain why, but there's an indication that he's trying to bond with the family in his own private way, which leads the father to wonder whether or not Yang had a soul, whether he was truly a boy in there.
Would you read just a couple paragraphs from that story?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Yang came to us fully programmed. There wasn't a baseball game, pizza slice, bicycle ride, or movie that I could introduce him to. Early on, I attempted such outings to create a sense of companionship, as though Yang were a foreign exchange student in our home. I took him to see the Tigers play in Comerica Park. He sat and ate peanuts with me, and when he saw me cheer, he followed suit and put his hands in the air, but there's no sense that he was enjoying the experience. Ultimately, these attempts at camaraderie, from visiting haunted houses to tossing a football around the backyard, felt awkward, as though Yang were humoring me, and so after a couple months I gave up. He lived with us, ate food, privately dumped his stomach canister, brushed his teeth, read Mika goodnight stories, and went to sleep when we shut off the lights. All the same, he was an important addition to our lives. You could always count on him to keep conversation going with some fun fact about China that none of us knew. I remember driving with him, listening to World Drum on NPR, when he said from the back seat, "This song utilizes the zun, an ancient Chinese instrument organized around minor third intervals." Other times he'd tell us fun facts, like, one afternoon when we'd all gotten ice cream at Old World Creamery, he turned to Mika and said, "Did you know ice cream was invented in China over 4,000 years ago?" His delivery of this info was a bit mechanical, a linguistic trait we attempt to keep Mika from adopting. but there was a lack of passion to his statements, as though he wasn't interested in the facts. But Kyra and I understood this to be the result of his being an early model. And when one considered the moments when he turned to Mika and say, "I love you, little sister," there was no way to deny what an integral part of our family he was.
I love your Yang voice.
Yeah, right.
It's Alexander Weinstein reading from the first story in his collection of science fiction and speculative fiction stories called Children of the New World. So you're saying that 5 years after Yang, he won't sound like a robot. He will have the kind of fluid speech that will sound quite human. That's a little scary, too.
Yeah, I think so. I think they'd get rid of the glitches. Also, the fact that he malfunctions so violently, they'd probably get a bunch of customer complaints about that.
Call here from Kenneth in Minneapolis. Hi, Kenneth. Thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What are you thinking about?
I just want to make a comment about being social and playing video games.
Yeah, good.
So I play a lot of video games. I play especially a game called Dota 2. It's a competitive game, and I probably log over 5,000 hours on it now.
Wow.
But, yeah, a lot of time. But in gaming, I want to just say, like, especially competitive gaming, when it's team-based, you make a lot of friends, and it kept me connected with all my friends from high school through college. Like, we still play that game. And without that, I would not have, like, the social interaction that I do day-to-day with them.
Really?
So, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I made friends all around the world as well, from the Netherlands to Italy and things like that. And I don't play with them as much, but I do play with them. So, culturally, like, keeps me connected globally. Whereas, like, we'll talk about Donald Trump, we'll talk about Hillary Clinton, things like that. So, like, it gives me a good aspect of how other people around the world are thinking of us as Americans.
Yeah.
And, you know, things like that. It's also, like, my girlfriend recently has been talking about how her friend, she's more of a social person, has to be face-to-face, hang out with people.
Mm-hmm.
She's been talking about how it's been rough because her friends have been so busy doing this, like, work stuff, college stuff. Whereas every day I'm playing games and I'm communicating with my friends. So I don't want to say she's jealous, and by no means is she jealous, but she gets that bit of, like, she wishes that it was that easy for her to not have to have a face-to-face social.
Yeah. So you get the kind of social interaction that she isn't getting as much because she doesn't have the time to hang out with her friends one-on-one.
Exactly. And I mean, I still do face-to-face with my friends, like hang out when on the weekends or whenever we can, but it's just not a reality when, I mean, I'm working 10, 12 hours a day, 5, 6 days a week. I'm tired when I go home. The last thing I want to do is go back out and, go on my computer. I can easily play with my friends for a few hours before bed, talk to them, socialize, see what's going on in their lives.
Yeah. You know, Kenneth, you're kind of, I mean, Alexander, you were talking about this earlier. It's he's just described that winding down thing that that we were kind of marveling over with technology, right, at the end of the day.
Right. And the points he's making are great, that there is a community online that you can connect with, and gamers most certainly have that community and feel that it's incredibly important to them. And I like that he also says, "I also go out and do face-to-face," because I think that's the key. My son plays a lot of games online, and so he has a whole group of friends from school that he'll connect with. And in one way, that's great. In another way, it is spooky to watch my son sitting alone in the living room talking to all these virtual friends, where they're just feeling like if the power went out right now, what would happen to all these virtual friends? Where would they go?
Yeah.
And so I think that while it serves that community, I think that's very good. There's also this edge where I'm seeing people wanting less and less FaceTime, actual FaceTime interaction.
Right.
Where my students, for example, say they're much more comfortable texting than actually having to talk to somebody. We were having a conversation about dating, modern dating, and they said, well, I'd never call somebody I was interested in. And I said, why not? And they said, well, because then you'd hear their voice and that's scary, right? And so there is this kind of beginning of virtual friendships, or even I was thinking about Facebook and the hypothetical friendships we have on Facebook, where we know that friends we haven't talked to for a dozen years just had a child or are getting married or it's their birthday. But really all we're doing is pressing like on the screen, and that amounts to the friendships we have unless we actually go and see them, right? Unless we have those real experiences. And I guess I am arguing that we need those real experiences for true intimacy, that one can have very deep friendships through online social media. I think it also increases the superficial friendships that we can have, or the friendships we believe we have until, you know, push comes to shove and can you help me move this weekend? And then you see how many people respond to that Facebook invite.
Eric says to me, I call hypocrisy on you, whining about video games leading to isolation while cheering books. The biggest games are multiplayer. And then he adds, I play games for the same reason you watch TV and read, all the same mindset. If anything, games are more interactive. Alexander Weinstein is with us this morning. We're talking about his collection, Children of the New World. Here's something I want to raise on the other side of news. I'm interested in how he thinks about whether these stories have to have a kind of moral embedded in them. This is something that I talked about with Denis Bichard a couple of weeks ago, and I'm interested in what Alexander has to say about that. So we'll pick that up on the other side of news. Phil, what's leading the newscast this hour?
Well, Carrie, the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension has given its report on the Philando Castile shooting to the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. The BCA has led the investigation of the fatal police shooting of Castile since it occurred in July. Castile was killed by a St. Anthony police officer during a traffic stop in Falcon Heights. County Attorney John Choi says his office will review the case, but he offered no timeline on how long it might take. Secretary of State John Kerry is threatening to cut off all contacts with Moscow over Syria unless Russian and Syrian government attacks on Aleppo end. The State Department says Kerry issued the ultimatum in a phone call to Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Kerry's spokesman John Kirby says Kerry expressed grave concern over Russian and Syrian government attacks on hospitals, water supplies, and other civilian infrastructure. Dutch-led criminal investigators say they have solid evidence a Malaysian jet was shot down in 2014 by a Buk missile that was moved into eastern Ukraine from Russia. Dutch national police say communications intercepts show pro-Moscow rebels deployed and fired the missile. It blasted Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 out of the sky at 33,000 feet, killing all 298 people on board. A top-ranking Democratic lawmaker says intelligence officials have reached a clear consensus the Russian government was behind the hack of the Democratic National Committee emails earlier this year. John Conyers of Michigan, senior Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, says the FBI should investigate whether Russia is working to undermine the U.S. presidential election. And the Palestinian president is expressing sadness over the death of former Israeli leader Shimon Peres. In a statement, Mahmoud Abbas said he has sent a condolence letter to Peres's family expressing sorrow and sympathy. He called Peres a partner in reaching a peace of the brave. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 10:40.
Hi, I'm Chris Farrell. Join me for the next Conversations on the Creative Economy on September 29th with Ravi Norman of Thor Construction about how technological advances are changing industry practices. Get your tickets now by going to nprnews.org/creative economy.
I'm Tom Weber. Next hour on NPR News, we'll discuss the Wells Fargo CEO forfeiting $41 million. You'll also hear a conversation about environmental justice in Minnesota, and then a warning if you use worms for composting, the worms might be threatening Minnesota forests. We'll explain at 11.
Support comes from the Meander Upper Mississippi River Art Crawl, September 30th through October 2nd. A self-guided tour of 45 regional artists located throughout five counties in western Minnesota. Details online at artsmeander.com.
I am at the Westminster Town Hall Forum at the Westminster Presbyterian Church tonight at 7 o'clock with Jeffrey Toobin. It's free. Boy, that doesn't happen very often, right? So if you have an evening open, he's got this interesting new book about the Patty Hearst kidnapping. And yeah, we'll be talking politics. We have to. He does a lot of commentary on CNN about politics. If you can't make it to the conversation in person, you'll hear a segment tomorrow during the show. We'll pull out a little excerpt, and then you'll hear the full conversation next week on NPR News Presents. Back to the discussion this hour with Alexander Weinstein and his book of stories called Children of the New World. Alexander, I'm going to grab a couple of calls here for reading recommendations, and then we'll come back to that question that I raised as we went to news. To Larry in Minneapolis. Hi, Larry. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi, Carrie. Unlike you, I've been, you know, reading science fiction mainly as my entertainment kind of reading since I was 9 years old, and I discovered that there could be good guy monsters as well as bad guy monsters, and Heinlein's Half Spacesuit Will Travel.
Uh-huh.
I'm 64 now, so I've been doing it a long time.
You have.
But I would, you know, if you're really looking for true classics, the two that really jump to mind to me are Frank Herbert's Dune and Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land. Dune, because a lot of people ascribe to it as being the first real serious treatment in novels of environmentalism, of the impact humanity, people can have on an entire planet's environment. And, you know, a lot of science fiction readers, as I say, and even scientists will point to that novel and say that really was the beginning of at least one segment of people's consciousness of what we are doing to the environment or can do to the environment.
Okay. So Dune is the recommendation, Frank Herbert. Okay.
Series that he wrote after that, and his son, Brian Herbert, continued working from his notes and things afterwards. It's like 15 you know, novels at this point in the series.
Okay.
The other one has Stranger in a Strange Land by Heinlein introduced the concept of what I would the term he used was grok, G-R-O-K.
Uh-huh.
And it was developing an understanding. To grok something was to develop an understanding of something at a core level that's beyond, way, way beyond the superficial. And it's a person who comes into, it's the classic outsider coming into our community and trying to understand, to grok the world he is now living in.
Okay.
Because he was raised in a kind of a Tarzan kind of isolation in Mars by an alien culture, and now he's back on Earth. And so you get lots of perspectives on society and how a misfit can fit into it. So
Larry, I really appreciate how you've been thinking about this. Alexander, have you read Dune or Strangers in a Strange Land?
I have not. Once again, evidence.
It's weird to me that you don't read more science fiction.
Isn't it? I know. It's really bizarre.
What's the deal?
What is the deal?
Yeah.
I started out really, I suppose, with Stephen King. And then that led me into horror. It's probably, you know, with a little bit, Stephen King did very little bit of fantasy sometimes and certainly played with some science fiction.
Yeah.
But then that led to people like David Foster Wallace, Kafka, and so a little more of the, I suppose, mainstream literary or postmodern literary realist field. And it was at that point that I started. Well, Tom Robbins was a huge influence on me because he was having such fun. But he's definitely not a sci-fi writer in any way. He introduced me probably to Kurt Vonnegut, who's probably the closest, you know, him, Orwell, Aldous Huxley. That's probably the closest I dipped into science fiction.
Yeah.
And Vonnegut is a huge, I'm a huge fan of Vonnegut. And yet, I don't think Vonnegut is really sci-fi. I don't know that he'd be put in that section, right? He's much more considered, I suppose, literary satire or humor.
I have a recommendation here from Aaron, who says Slaughterhouse-Five to read that somebody, Vonnegut, yeah, being mentioned on the page?
Yeah, at nprnews.org/live, Elizabeth says, Kurt Vonnegut, everyone loves and recommends Slaughterhouse-Five and Cat's Cradle, but Sirens of Titan and Player Piano are my favorites. Everything is still maybe more so relevant today. He's such an interesting outlook on people. And then other recommendations, it's kind of a smackdown between Frank Herbert Dune and Ursula Le Guin's Left Hand of Darkness.
Really?
On here. Grace says, Dune by Frank Herbert, classic science fiction with amazing characters and historical parallels. And then Rhonda loves Left Hand of Darkness because it's gender-bending sci-fi.
I have to confess to leaning towards Ursula Le Guin, and here's the reason. She has a new book out where she is writing about writing and how she's thinking about writing. And I thought, and who knows, we might be able to get her on the show.
That'd be amazing.
Right? Could happen.
I'm skeptical.
I know.
She was born in 1927, I think.
But she's still writing, Steph.
That's amazing.
just say, yeah, that could be you, Alexander.
Right, yeah.
Writing
hopefully
into your ninth or eighth decade there. Hey,
absolutely.
So this is something that I've been curious about with you, because it seems like, not that you're moralizing in these stories, but there does seem to be, as I said at the beginning, kind of a cautionary lens put over some of these stories you're telling. And this is something that I was talking with somebody who writes from a very different perspective of you, Denis Bouchard. He's a Canadian novelist and a war correspondent. But we had this really interesting discussion about putting morals or lessons into fiction writing. And I want you to hear why he told me he was pretty uncomfortable with that.
So I spend a lot of time trying to examine my stories and take them apart and see if there's truth to them, and if, you know, there's a real resonance there, or if, you know, sometimes that feeling, for example, when you read a story that has a moral at the end, and you kind of feel it's not true, it's too simple, it's too closed. Life is more complex than that.
Yes.
And whenever I write something, I always sort of evaluate it to try to make sure that I'm giving it the complexity of life.
So, Alexander, how do you think about putting some kind of moral or lesson into your stories?
I look at how am I treating my characters, the morality with which, as a writer, I approach my characters, and am I treating them with dignity? And what I mean by this is, earlier in my writing career, I wrote a lot of scathing pieces where I was going to make fun of a character. I was setting the character up in order to prove a point and in many ways do that moral thing, right? I wanted the moral, and this character was going to get me to that. And so I really stepped on my characters as my soapbox. And what happened was the characters talked among themselves and they said, you know, this author's a jerk. We're not working for him anymore. And all the stories dried up on me because I wasn't approaching my characters as though they were human beings with their own hopes and dreams and desires and hearts. And that transformed my work at that point when I realized that, when my characters went on strike, I call that period of my writing life.
Huh.
And so I approach the characters now with, they should have great amounts of heart in their life, right? They should care about their families, try to be good people, try to be good lovers, and especially parents, since there are so many children in this collection, right, that are being taken care of.
Right.
And when I do that, what I find is morals that I was hoping to say in the story begin to play out naturally through the characters because they're coping and trying to deal with a world that's askew in some ways, that has problems of which I'm trying to address. And because of that, then I think a lot of my stories do have a moral in there. There's often a political statement being made. Like in Ice Age, you've got all the poor people in single-decker igloos and then the one rich guy in a double-decker igloo burning up all the wood, right? That's a pretty clear metaphor there for, in many ways, Occupy Wall Street and the 1% and these sort of critiques. And so what I find is if I want to make a critique like that, I try to bury it as well in a lot of metaphor so that the setting and the landscape and the characters all work together in very unexpected ways.
So recommend your favorite Kurt Vonnegut for us, and we'll put it on our thread page where we write about books.
Cat's Cradle was mentioned, and that's my favorite. I think Cat's Cradle is just brilliant. very humorous, great satire, and Vonnegut really at his best.
Hey, thank you very much, Alexander. Really enjoyed this.
This was fantastic. Thanks so much for having me.
Alexander Weinstein's book is called Children of the New World. If you're going to read Vonnegut, maybe you're going to come back to it. Maybe you read Vonnegut in college or high school, and it's time to come back. Alexander recommends Cat's Cradle. You can read all about his book and maybe a little bit about Vonnegut on the thread, nprnews.org/thread.